Hello and welcome to Earth Matters, environmental justice news from Australia and around the world. Produced in the studios of 3CR in Melbourne and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. I'm Tisha Nahan. On this week's show, we look at climate change, from cause to effect. Bushfires are one of the most immediate and dramatic examples of the effects of climate change in Australia. Already this year, Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia have experienced damaging bushfires, with the WA fires declared a natural disaster. And the memories of catastrophic bushfires are not too distant for many in Tasmania, the ACT and New South Wales. Professor Leslie Hughes has authored a number of reports for the Climate Council on the link between climate change and bushfires in Australia. I started by asking her to explain that link.
Well, look, you need three things to have a bushfire. You need for the fire to start, so you need an ignition source. You need something to burn, that is the fuel. And then you need the right sort of weather conditions on the day to make sure the fire actually carries. And climate change can affect all three of those things, so some things more than others. So mostly it doesn't affect ignition, so the incidence of lightning can increase in warm weather, so potentially in the future there is some scientific evidence to say we might get more lightning strikes and therefore more ignitions from lightning. Climate does affect fuel quite a lot, but it affects it in rather complex ways. So obviously if there's been a long dry period, such as during a drought, then fuel is more flammable. But in order to get fuel to grow in the first place, you need rain. So often the worst conditions for fire are in a season that's very dry, but where there's been a wet season previously, where the fuel has built up and then dried out. But by far the most important impact of climate on fire is how it affects weather on a single day. And we know that, especially in southeastern Australia, we've been in a long-term drying and warming trend. We're getting longer, hotter heat waves, potentially longer, hotter periods of dry weather. And together these things increase the incidence or increase the probability that on any particular day there'll be worse conditions for fire.
And so what we're really seeing is an increase in the propensity for frequency as well as ferocity of bushfires?
That's right. So extreme fire weather, which is mostly measured via weather variables, has been increasing significantly over the last 30 years in Victoria. We've also seen the fire season in Victoria start earlier and last longer. So the period of the year during which there is dangerous fire weather is also increasing.
And you've noted in your report that Victoria has been the state hardest hit by recent bushfires. Can you also just run us through how it's affecting the other states such as New South Wales, ACT, South Australia, which have also all experienced quite severe bushfires in recent years?
Yes, well, Victoria's been the worst. I mean, even though Victoria only covers about 3% of Australia's land area, it's sustained about half the economic damages and more than half the fatalities from bushfires over the last century. But certainly bushfires also have affected Western Australia, South Australia, and obviously quite recently the ACT and New South Wales particularly, and also Tasmania in recent times. So basically right across southern Australia, we are very prone to bushfires during the summer. By contrast, up in the tropical areas, bushfires occur on quite a different cycle. They tend to occur in the dry season after the fuel has built up in the wet season and a more regular part of the landscape. In southern Australia, you get these bushfire conditions that occur in these temperate, what we call dry sclerophyll or eucalypt forests that are highly flammable, and that's where the real danger occurs because we have lots of communities that live on that urban bushland fringe.
And some people are very eager to say that bushfires have always happened in Australia and are very keen to explain them as just a part of the way of life here and a part of the natural cycles of the environment. Yeah. How is what we're seeing now different to bushfires in the past?
Well, it's a question of distinguishing between a cycle, which we've always had, and a trend being imposed on that cycle. So, yes, we have always had fires in Australia, at least for the last few million years, because it's a dry, hot country with the sort of vegetation that burns very well. But superimposed on that regular natural variability is a new trend of increasing extreme fire danger weather. And that's because we're in a long-term drying trend, as I said before, and mainly because we're in a long-term warming trend. So we do have that background variability that's always going to be there. But on top of that, we've got a superimposed trend of increased risk.
Speaking of trends, 2014 has now been officially announced as the hottest year on record globally. So what can we expect from the future in terms of these, in terms of bushfires in Australia?
Well, we have to be, the reason that we've called all our bushfire reports Be Prepared is that's what we need to be. This is not going to change anytime soon. I mean, most of the years since the year 2000 have been record-breaking years for heat. So prior to 2014 being a record-breaking year, 2013 was the hottest year in Australia, et cetera, et cetera. So what we've got to be prepared for is increases in fire risk. At the same time as our population is growing and more people are building houses and developing communities in bushfire-prone areas, the risk is increasing. So we need to be better at managing that risk, be it via just better planning regulations and building regulations. We certainly need to be resourcing our emergency services to deal with the risk much better. So one of the stats that we quote in our report is from a report done for the Professional Firefighters Association of Australia, which indicates that with increasing population and with increased risk from climate change, the number of professional firefighters will need to about double by 2030 compared to 2010 levels. So increased bushfire risk costs lives, it costs money to deal with, and that's just going to be a part of our life for the next few decades.
So picking up on this message of preparedness and what you just mentioned about our need to acknowledge the increased risk and our ever-increasing contact with bushfires and their effects, the devastating effects of recent bushfires has been really well documented, and I think is really well understood in terms of the obvious effects of tragic loss of life, livelihoods, properties. In your reports for the Climate Council, you've noted a number of other serious effects from increased bushfires and severity of bushfires due to climate change, effects that we perhaps wouldn't immediately think of. Can you perhaps run us through what some of these are?
Well, yes, some of those effects are psychological, both on people that are in communities where they have either lost loved ones or lost property, but also the trauma on our emergency services, you know, firefighters dealing with things like the Black Saturday bushfires. That's not an easy thing to cope with at a personal level. So fires, you know, have an immediate impact on life and injury and property and livestock and water catchments and all of those sorts of things. But they also have much longer-term impacts. They have longer-term impacts on the economy, longer-term impacts on health, and particularly longer-term impacts on mental health.
Bringing it now to the future and specifically action, there's a scientific consensus that dramatic action needs to be taken on climate change. What is that? What action has been called for?
Well, we need to move as rapidly as possible to as close to a zero carbon economy as we possibly can. Now, it's going to be difficult for Australia because a lot of our wealth rests on our fossil fuel industry, both in the past and currently. But the world simply cannot afford to keep redistributing carbon from the Earth's crust into the atmosphere because it's heating the planet, it's changing our climate, it's affecting our life support system, and there will be a limit to what we can cope with and adapt to. So together with all of the other countries in the world, Australia has to get with the program, has to realise that we're part of the problem and we have to be part of the solution. So long term, short, medium and long term, we need to be moving towards a way of life that is not necessarily poorer in quality, but we need to be producing energy from different sources. So we need government policies that support renewable energy rather than encourage disinvestment. We need policies that, in my view, encourage divestment from fossil fuels, and we need to move into this century with a different frame of mind about how we can exploit the environment from how we've thought of previously.
Professor Leslie Hughes of the Climate Council. And you're listening to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories on the Community Radio Network. While bushfires are one of the most dramatic examples of how climate change is affecting us right now, let's look at the other side of the equation, at one of Australia's biggest contributions to global greenhouse gas emissions. Next up, we speak to Josh Creaser from 350.org Australia about the campaign to stop the Galilee Basin coal mining projects in Queensland, which, if they go ahead, would double Australia's coal exports. Josh, could you start by just giving our listeners an introduction to the Galilee Basin mining projects? What's that all about?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on today to talk about what is really the biggest climate issue facing Australia at the moment, I would say. So the Galilee Basin coal mines stand out as one of the largest sources of potential carbon dioxide in the world. They're a series of nine proposed mega coal mines up in central Queensland. Now, we call them mega coal mines because each individual mine itself might consist of 6 to 10 pits, open pits, and 6 to 10 underground pits as well. These are truly huge coal mines. Now, to put it in some perspective, how big they are in a global sense, if we were to dig up all this coal, ship it off to places like India and for it to be burnt, around about 6% of the remaining carbon budget that we have to stay below 2 degrees, that red line set by scientists worldwide, if we were to stay below that 2 degree level of warming, these mines would chew through 6% of that carbon budget.
So that represents a massive amount of greenhouse gas emissions there. You describe these as mega projects. Can you give us paint a bit of a picture for our listeners as in terms of, you know, what this would look like? So these proposed projects are in central Queensland, about 500 kilometres west of Mackay. What would these look like if we were to be looking at these mines if they were to be built?
Yes, yeah, so for listeners that are familiar with areas like the Latrobe Valley or the Hunter Valley where there are already many existing coal mines, the Galilee Basin would be like that, but even bigger, even a greater scar on the landscape. So the Galilee area, as it currently sits, doesn't have any coal or gas infrastructure. It's farmland, very productive farmland. There's also some really precious pockets of biodiversity across that landscape. These nine mega mines, as we call them, five of them would be bigger than any other existing coal mine that we already have in Australia. And I think their collective footprint would be something like the size of the Australian Capital Territory, where I'm from. So a truly extraordinary scar on the landscape. And of course, if you then take your view a bit broader than just the mines themselves, there'll be about 500 kilometres of rail crossing more prime agricultural land to Abbott Point. At Abbott Point, as I'm sure your listeners would know, there are plans to build the world's largest coal port, this highly controversial project that really defined much in the Queensland election that's just gone by, that would be built on the edge of the Great Barrier Reef, and of course, significantly put at risk that most precious marine ecosystem.
And you've mentioned that the Abbott Point coal terminal and the reef in general was actually quite a significant issue in the recent Queensland election. The new Labor Queensland government has gone as far as appointing a minister for the Great Barrier Reef. Historically, though, both Labor and Liberal National governments have been very friendly to mining right across the country, Queensland no exception. What are we looking at now with the new Queensland government and a minister for the reef? What are the prospects for the Abbott Point coal terminal and also the dredging, which was one of the big issues that mobilised a lot of Queensland voters?
Absolutely. And just to say, like, incredible to see how Queenslanders did mobilise around that issue of the reef and how many people got out on the streets, protested against that issue and did change the election outcome. But as you say, both the Liberal Party and the Labor Party across Australia have always been in bed with the coal mining industry, and we still see that ALP in Queensland ultimately supports the Galilee Basin coal mines and the Abbott Point terminal going ahead. But they are suggesting some tweaks around the edges in terms of not going for offshore dumping of the dredge material or allowing that to happen in the wetlands on the shore. They'll find another way to do that. That's their plan, to work with the industry to come up with an alternate proposal. They're going to take away a bit of public funding for the project, which we absolutely welcome. There shouldn't be taxpayer money going into a project like this. But as I say, ultimately, the ALP still support these projects going ahead. So the work of campaigners and communities across the country is still absolutely vital to make sure this crazy project doesn't go ahead. And to come back to the point you made that we now have a minister for the reef. If a minister for the reef was to truly, you know, take on that responsibility and protect this reef for generations to come, they would have to reject the idea of opening up 9 mega coal mines outright. Even Greg Hunt, the federal environment minister, has noted in one of his most recent reports that climate change is one of the biggest impacts on the Great Barrier Reef. So to be facilitating 9 mega coal mines open up at this stage flies in the face of a mandate to protect that reef.
So, Josh, can you tell us who's involved in these proposed coal mining projects? There's 9 proposed coal mining projects in total in the Galilee Basin. You noted 5 of them would be bigger than anything else currently in operation in Australia. There's a number of companies currently involved. Who's involved and how far along the pipeline are these plans for these mining projects?
Yeah, so to look back at the history of it briefly, in 2011, when the coal price was at record highs, a bunch of companies, many of them foreign, but with a few notable Australians involved, like Clive Palmer and Gina Reinhart, began to lick their lips. For the first time really ever, the Galilee Basin coal mines looked financially feasible. So this is when we saw a bunch of mining leases being bought up by a range of local and foreign companies and them starting to put forward proposals for how they would, you know, get a 500-kilometre rail line out there, build the port, build all the infrastructure for the mine. Things have changed considerably since 2011. Firstly, the coal price is now reaching record lows and many analysts are predicting that it's going to stick around in the doldrums for quite some time to come. A number of the companies that were going to be involved, probably most notably GVK, an Indian company, have not been able to come up with the kind of finance that is required to get these mines off the ground. So we're left with really one major player in the Galilee at the moment, and that is a company called Adani. Adani is an Indian company. They have investments in a large number of ports and some coal infrastructure in India. This is really their first major international project. And so they're going from having quite good experience with ports to now suddenly proposing to build what is one of the world's largest coal mines, the Carmichael coal mine, which is one of the 9 mega ones, out in the Galilee Basin, to construct a 500-kilometre rail line to expand the Abbott Point port and then ship that coal off to India. they do not have any really relevant experience in pulling together such a huge integrated project. And what's more, we've just over the last couple of weeks had some pretty damning investigations come out from Fairfax, which show that, for one, Adani makes huge use of tax havens. They have a very complicated and riddled corporate structure where actually understanding who owns what in their empire is very difficult to work out. And there's allegations that the front man for the company is in fact not the one actually pulling the strings. His brother, who has a history of kind of criminal activity in India, is behind most of the projects. And so there are a lot of concerns about, you know, Adani as an operator, both on environmental grounds and, yeah, on its corporate record.
And what about the coalition of groups who are opposing these projects? You're obviously from 350.org, but you're not the only organisation who's been involved in the campaign against the Galilee Basin mining projects and the Abbot Point coal terminal, which the coal will be exported through. Can you give us an idea of, you know, we've heard of a range of companies which are sort of vying for these coal resources, but who's the coalition that's fighting against this?
So as your listeners probably know, that there's been quite incredible moves in the last, you know, 12, 24 months in Australia within the movement to oppose new coal projects. Perhaps like the best example of this has been the campaign against the Maules Creek coal mine in New South Wales, which has been a highly controversial project, which has united traditional owners, farmers, city folks, people from right across the spectrum, faith organisations, doctors, lawyers, all banding together to stand up and oppose that project on prime farmland and on sacred cultural sites of the Gomori people. That kind of collaboration and movement building is what we're seeing form around the Abbot Point campaign as well, a kind of never-before-seen coalition of groups working together, which I'm sure must send shivers down the spines of the politicians and the companies that are backing these projects. So with the Abbot Point, we have a bunch of local groups up and down that coast who are banding together to stand up to the port because it will impact on tourism jobs on the Great Barrier Reef. It'll radically reshape those communities if there's a whole stack of fly-in and fly-out workers to the area. We've seen farmers up and down the rail line and out at the proposed Galilee Basin coal mines voicing their concerns, despite efforts by the industry to hush them up with, you know, contracts and negotiations. Many have spoken out. Many have taken the companies to court. Some have been successful. And, of course, a wide range of environmental NGOs are supporting these campaigns as well. So groups like Greenpeace, the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, 350, Wilderness Society, and many others are kind of coming together both at the national level and the local level to form a united front against these mines and against the port. So I think that kind of collaboration, the kind of community organising that's underpinning that, is really exciting for our movement, and I think does poise us you know, very powerfully to take on and stop these projects going ahead.
And for listeners who moved to take action on this issue, how can they get involved in the campaign?
So one of the key campaign focuses post the Queensland election, which has kind of brought us all a bit more time because they're going to take a slower approach to getting these projects off the ground. One of the key things people can do is put pressure on the big four Australian banks not to invest in these projects. So if Adani is to get their plans off the ground, they will need significant financial backing from foreign and or domestic banks. Now, last year, there was an Australian Financial Review article which named the Commonwealth Bank as a lead arranger for Adani, i.e. they were going to help arrange the finance that they need to get this project off the ground. So we need to build huge public pressure first on CommBank, but then any other one of the big Australian banks that looks like it wants to invest in these projects. It's simply not appropriate that our national banks, with their hefty profits and with their dubious financial planning history that has come out in the last couple months, would be seeking to invest in projects that would alter the composition of the atmosphere and change the climate worldwide and would inflict such damage on the Great Barrier Reef. Beyond that, they're investing in a company which has a dubious kind of economic and environmental history and may very well not be able to even pull off these projects if the finance came to the table. So what folks can do is put their bank on notice. If you bank with Commonwealth or any other of the big four banks, get in there, let the managers know that you will switch your accounts if you don't see change, and follow through that on that intention. And if you go to the 350.org.au website, you'll find resources and information on how to do that. I'd also invite your listeners to keep an eye out over the next few weeks. We'll be launching a big campaign, which will be all about CommBank and the other big four banks pulling out of the Abbot Point coal terminal. And there'll be ways for folks to get involved in their local areas by taking on action at their local branches, by building that public pressure against Commonwealth and the other big four banks, and sending a very clear message that it's time for our financial institutions to no longer invest in the industry of yesteryear, but to look to the future and to look to a fossil-free future.
Josh Creaser from 350.org Australia. You're listening to Earth Matters, Australia's weekly environmental justice program for community radio. I'm Tisha Nahern. For more information on the campaign to stop the Galilee Basin coal mining projects and the Abbot Point coal port, you can check out 350.org.au and also the McKay Conservation Group, as well as the National Lock the Gate Alliance. Search for those online. And to find those reports on the links between bushfires and climate change, you can go to the Climate Council's website, climatecouncil.org.au. If you've missed any of today's program, you can find our podcasts at 3cr.org.au/earthmatters. Thanks to both my guests today, Professor Leslie Hughes of the Climate Council and Josh Creaser of 350.org Australia. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support and the Community Radio Network for getting the program out to you. Earth Matters is produced in the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Kulin Nations. You can contact us on 03 9419 8377 or at earthmatters3cr@gmail.com. I hope you can tune in next week for more Earth Matters.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.